Okay, so now we're recording on here, and hopefully that'll pick things up. So I'd like to just go around and have people say who they are and what your relationship is to our subject, and we'll start from there.
Okay, so my name's Dave Abbott. I'm Ralph Abbott's first son. I grew up in this house and moved away in 1970 to go to school, and I now live in Arizona. But during the time that I was growing up, I also worked with him on a couple of summers and also after school when I was in high school.
And my name is Trinkle Jones, and I am the wife of David Abbott. I'm a former National Park Service archaeologist and am very interested to learn about this process.
Hi, I'm John Abbott, Ralph Abbott's second son. Again, grew up in this house and still remain in the immediate area and owner of this home now. I also worked for my father during my younger years, and again, hope to see this something happen here with this equipment supplies.
I'm Fred Merriam on the Chelmsford Historical Commission, and written a few books about Chelmsford now. So I have an interest in the mills in North and West Chelmsford, and here to look on as we go through this process of liquidating a historic collection related to the mills here in North Chelmsford.
Okay, so why don't you tell us now who we're talking about?
We're talking about Ralph Abbott, born
1921
in Barry, South Barry, Massachusetts, son of a wool sorter by trade, grandson of a...
His name is John Abbott.
His name was John Abbott. My grandfather, John Abbott, is the son of a immigrant from England.
In the Yorkshire area.
In the Yorkshire area, that was also involved in the wool trade.
When did he immigrate?
He immigrated to Boston in 1889, and he died of accidental injuries in a mill in Lawrence, Massachusetts, in 1896. He was the son of William Abbott of Yorkshire, England. Who lived from 1845 to 1885, and William Abbott was a mule spinner in the mills in England.
Okay, so your father, then when did he start working, or about when?
He graduated from high school and took a job with Chrysler Corporation, which was a mill, I guess, in town. I'm not exactly sure where.
Number 70 Princeton Street.
Yeah, which was part of Southwest, I believe, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so he learned how to do the pin setting when he was working there. And that was before the Second World War. And then when the war came along, he ended up working as a welder in the shipyards. And did that for some time, and then actually went into the Navy at the end of the war. When he left the Navy, he came back and I think started working for Folly Kemp at that point.
I believe so. That's the way I've understood it.
And what kind of a company were they?
It was a textile pin setting business as well, and that was located under the hardware store here in North Chelmsford. From there, he went. They moved the business over to Tingsborough Road, which was just another stone's throw away down behind the old Tony and Ann's in the junkyard back there. And my father got involved with the volunteer fire department, and he worked for a company called C&M Bacon and Sons, which was a building contractor outfit that did a lot of construction of Fort Devens at the time. And he worked part-time in the pin-setting business down for this guy named Folly Kemp. what the name of the business there is, I'm not quite sure if it was not just a textile bin supply or if it was something else. I don't know. At some point in time, he acquired the business from Farley Kemp, continued to run it down on Tingsboro Road, became a full-time firefighter for a couple of years, and did the pin setting business on his days off or whenever he could, and continued to grow the business. And then he stopped being a fireman, and that's when he became a full-time pin setter. And I think at that point in time is when he bought the business from Farley Kemp. Continued to run it down there for a while. My mother had some health issues during the early 60s, I guess. And he moved the business up here to the home so that he could not only run the business, cut the overhead, and be able to take care of my mother and the family at the same time. And this is where it stayed until the mid-1970s, I guess, when he retired. My mother took over the business to keep it going, and then eventually they closed it up.
Okay, and can you tell us a little bit about what pin setting actually is?
Pin setting is the repair of the steel combs that would go into a machine that would comb the wool. That's basically what a pin setter job was. They have all different, through the evolution of those combing machines, they had all different styles and shapes of these steel combs.
All right, so you were telling me earlier about two different styles of combs, one where the holes were drilled and the pins were in, and the other.
From my recollection now, and I'm sorry, if I may be 100% wrong, but the first combs were called circles. They were probably a foot or so in diameter, probably they were open circle. They were probably maybe an inch and a half thick, and they had many layers from the outside in of the pins, of the needles sticking out. And he would take and repair those. And then it came into what they call the flat bar, faller type. The first ones of those were called drill bars. And they were either single road or double road of these teeth. And he would either repair them or he would replace completely when they came in, along with taking the bars and straightening and cleaning them all up and whatnot. And then the next evolution was called a slotted bar, slotted faller, where they were either soldered in or they were channeled. There was a channel in the bar, and they were either soldered in or they were held in with an epoxy resin. And that was the newest version of that. And towards the end of it, they came, which actually was the demise of the pin setting business, was what they call the throwaway faller, which was made completely out of plastic, with the exception of had some steel reinforcing on the ends where it went into the machine and the teeth. And when those things got wrecked, they basically threw them away. And that, so there was no repair on those. So that was...
All right, so you were talking earlier about how he repaired the drilled bars when they came in. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell us about that again?
When the bars came in, the teeth being my fingers, they sat in a steel bar. And they were all, some of the reason why they came here was because they weren't sharp enough or they were bent. Maybe the bars themselves were bent, and all to do with maybe the wool sorter didn't find a little piece of bone, or somebody had thrown a cigarette butt in the raw wool, or piece of chewing gum, or a stick, and those bars were going in those machines at a very fast rate, and when they get in, they would bang everything up. So they pull those pieces out, and there was about 100. The flat bars, there was about 100 per run of those bars in the machine at a time. So they would take those out, and my father would either have them shipped here or he'd pick them up and sort through them and either repair them or replace the pins in them, clean them all up. And when he repaired them, he would take each individual tooth of that comb, he would break it off, and then he had some fine drifts that he could use that he could get down and bang that piece out, and it was a tapered pin. He'd bang that piece out, and then he would turn it over and replace it, and then he would take it to a special vice that he had, and he would take all the remaining ones that were salvageable, and he would tweak them back and forth to make them straight, and then take a piece of emery cloth and fix up the points on them, and then run them over the buffer wheel and clean them all up, put them back in the box, and then they'd be ready to go back to the mill. If he was going to completely replace them, he would take and put them into a shear and cut them all off so that they weren't sharp anymore. He'd put the bar into a vise, and then he had another piece of steel bar that was about an inch square, and he would pound all those pins all down through the backside.
Knock them out.
And then he had some special pliers. They weren't special pliers, but he had found some pliers that he could use that he would pull all of the pins out the backside, and then he would straighten the bar, clean it, and then he would put all the new tapered pins back in it, and bang them all back down again. And when he banged them in, they were tapered, so they'd fit nice and tight, and again they would be ready to go back to the mill.
Okay, and you also were talking about how he fixed the ones that were set in with epoxy.
Right. That was another generation of the faller bar. Again, those fallers would come in damaged, and you couldn't replace pin for pin on it. You had to replace the whole row. So he would take the bar, and if it was severely bent, he would straighten it, and then he'd put it into the heat machine, which was basically an electric welder type of a deal. Slide the bar into it, pull up on the two handles which would clamp it in, and then he had a foot pedal that would introduce the electricity to it, heat that bar up and crystallize the epoxy in it. And then he would scrape all that out, and then they would clean the bars, straighten them all, and then they had a process where they took, he called it a book, and they would set a piece of 3/8 styrofoam, put it in there, clamp it in, and they had all these brass jigs that was inside of it for all the different size pins, and those were flat pins at the time, so they would fit all those in there, bang them down into the styrofoam, and then peel the styrofoam out with the pins in it, set it into the faller bar, and then re-pour epoxy in it. And after the epoxy dried, they come and they peel the styrofoam off it, and then they'd be ready to go back to the mill. And the same process they had before they used the epoxy, they were experimenting with setting the pins in solder, which wasn't very successful, because you only had one shot at it. If you overheated it and tried to go back to fix something, you would screw all the because the solder was liquid, and there was no way to hold the pieces in it, so they would get all screwed up. So that was kind of a failed attempt to modernize the faller bar.
And how far would he go, actually, to pick up these things and deliver them?
He had companies that would deliver from all the way from New York. They'd come here with a tractor trailer, all over New England. Up in his biggest business was up and down the Merrimack River. He went to Maine. In his later days, he went to Maine to the rope companies up on the coast. I don't remember quite where it was, but it's up beyond Portland there somewhere. He had special days that he would pick up and deliver work, put the stuff in his car and say run up to Manchester, New Hampshire, or run to Lowell, or...
In talking to either your father or one of you, I thought someone told me he even got into Canada a little bit towards the end. Is that true?
Yeah.
And also down south, in South Carolina.
Yeah, there was...
Also Freddie Bacon. You talk about Freddie Bacon. You remember Freddie Baker?
Freddie Bacon?
Yeah, Bacon, not Bacon, Baker. He was a middleman. He was the guy that worked with my father. He had lots of contacts with mills up all around.
Right.
And he would bring in the work, and then he delivered the work to my dad.
Take a cut of the...
Yeah.
Take a cut of it.
So Freddie Baker was also a pin setter, but he preferred to do the more of the leg work, so to speak, rather than doing the actual repair work.
Right.
The business end.
Yeah.
And so my dad worked with him for quite some time, probably about 10 years, I'd say.
So there was the textile industry, and there was the rope making industry. Were there any other kind of industries that he was?
It's somewhere along the line, probably in the late 60s, 70s. That's when they started bringing in the nylons and the rayons and that type of work as well. They did a lot of combing for that up in. He had one company up in Wilton, New Hampshire. They did a lot of that specialty work for.
Now, was that textile or something else?
It was a textile mill. What they were doing with it, I never paid much attention to it. But it was a combing aspect of trying to get the rayon fibers or the nylon fibers in line. And it was they had a lot of trouble with it because it was the nylon and the rayon was very, very strong.
Yeah.
And if something was to go wrong, it would smash those fallers up like no tomorrow, where the wool was, a little bit less...
more forgiving.
A little more forgiving, yeah.
And how long did you travel around with them?
When I was a young kid. When I got into high school, I pretty much went out and did my own thing. But before that, we spent a lot of summers here. He'd always give us something to do. Back in the 60s, he had people that worked from 7 o'clock in the morning till 3, and he also had people coming in here and work until 8 or 9 o'clock at night, trying to get the work done.
And like, how many people would he have?
During the day, he probably, at one time in the area, he had 3 in himself.
3?
He had Tommy Buntell, Billy Clark, and Weston.
Oh, okay. I remember that.
Yep.
Later on, it was more like 2.
And then it went down to the Vietnam War came along and took one of them away to the draft. He saved Tommy Buntell from the draft because he was because he was involved in the textile industry that was
supporting
producing
the war effort. Yeah.
The war effort type, building the uniforms and the blankets, and it was all related to the war effort, so he was allowed to defer him from the draft and keep him. There was an old gentleman here, his name was
Mac McQuestion,
who was an old pin setter from somewhere who came to work.
Then McSheehy, Mrs. McSheehy, was her first name?
Yep. At some point in time, Margaret McSheehy worked
here. A woman? Was that during
the... Yeah.
No
yeah.
kidding.
Yeah. Johnny LeMessurier worked here at night. Then Scotty was the last.
Scotty Hoyt
was the last of the employees except for Mom. Scotty used to do... my father would do all the removal of, you know, put it in the machine, heating up and cleaning out. And Scotty would do all the prep work with setting the pins in the styrofoams, getting all that stuff ready to go, and he actually did the epoxy work because my father couldn't touch the epoxy.
Because of the allergy he had developed.
Yeah, the allergies, yeah.
Yeah.
So is it my understanding also that the final blow to the business was that a lot of it started to go overseas?
Yeah.
A lot of it during the progression here, during the heyday, when all these mills in the area were all combing or doing something with the wool, everything was going good. And then it progressively started to go south, south, south.
You mean south of in the U.S.?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And at the same time, the progression of those, of the faller bars, it became expensive to repair, so they came up with that disposable faller.
Right. Okay.
And that was really, you know, really the demise of the business.
Okay.
But it was at the fortunately, it was at the same time of you know, my father deciding to retire at his age and whatever. So it hurt him over the years, but not as if it was, you know, he was
in the prime 40, of life.
40 years old
yeah.
and trying to keep the business going.
Did you give the name of the business? It's there on the...
It's Not Chemsford Textile Business, Not Chemsford Textile Pin Supply. How that name came about, I have no idea.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, why don't we go downstairs now and look at the equipment that you have left, and you can talk about that.
Okay. Just want to mention a couple of things. I don't know if you realized it, but this is the pin setting shop at 70
yes,
Princess
I showed
Street.
Them.
On
the That's
front
the
cover.
Greatest thing. It's on the cover.
Yeah, and there's another picture that shows more of
can
the shop.
Can we show that to the camera here?
You can. And this actually, I think those rings are more like 2 to 3 feet in diameter. And R.T. Davis, I don't know, your dad might have known him because he actually took over as supervisor. It was North Chelmsford Machine and Supply Company. And when George C. Moore died, it became the Chrysler Company. Chrysler was an executive in the North Chelmsford Machine
and Ralph
Supply.
Did work for Chrysler because I have a directory
yeah.
entry
yeah.
for
well,
him that says
Richard T.
Chrysler.
Davis, who he's a young man in this picture right here with
the tie on.
I should note my father never wore a tie when he was at work.
Well, Richard was the pin setter since he was young in the backside, and they produced the belts and they did pin setting. They produced aprons and brushes, all sorts of things that they needed for the mills. So
that's a wonderful photograph.
And George C. Moore, actually, there's another photograph with all the employees standing out front.
Can I show this one?
And each employee is holding one of the products that they sell. It's called Silver and Gay Company because originally it was a machine shop, Silver and Gay.
I saw that.
George C. Moore started another company inside the Silver and Gay Company in kind of a wing that's right next to Princeton Street. And that was called the North Chelmsford Supply Company. So Silver and Gay became the North Chelmsford Machine Company
okay.
when the original owner passed away, and Ziba Gay. And then later, a few years later, they were combined to make the North Chelmsford Machine and Supply Company.
Now, you were talking earlier about the first machine shop in the state was right near here. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
He actually called it a machine shop, but he was actually one of the first in the world to make a turbine, I believe, from what I understand. From
he designed Very efficient turbines.
Was this a water-powered thing?
Water turbines, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Very efficient. I have several write-ups that show the product line that resulted, mm-hmm. like quarter horsepower, half, one horsepower size. So that he actually had some small and very efficient sizes. And the innovation that he had was that you could run them at quarter or half power or half flow and still get usable power. In other words, much higher efficiency than anything that was on the market. So it was a major innovation at the time. He was only there for 10 years.
And what was the name of the company?
Swain Turbine.
And do you know the dates of that?
I believe it was 1860 to 1870, and then it was gone. Now, he did move the factory. It was right down
here.
The street.
It's right
here. Oh, right this way. And you can still see...
quarter of a mile.
Not even.
The
eighth of a mile.
The pond on the other side of the road went under the road, and then it went through a sluiceway, and the mill was on the left side. There is a channel, and it's been all redone. The stones have all been reset. It's beautiful now. It had been falling apart 10 years ago, and I believe the town.
Well, they got a grant to fix the so-called dam.
Mm, mm-hmm. But the building was on the left side. It was 40 feet long, something like that, and that was the factory. And as John said, he lived in the house that Swain lived in. At number 3 Mission Road.
Now that dam was built to produce a pond, right? So they could do it for ice, supply ice.
They had an ice house there.
They did, yes. We have pictures. George Merrill has pictures of ice houses. Trouble is, he has several pictures purported to be Swain, and they're totally different. So
the ice houses in your book, they're not this pond.
No, they're
Freeman.
Freeman.
Yeah.
Freeman. Right. So I have George's pictures, but I couldn't figure out, because they were so different, that he has a picture of a tractor powering a belt, powering a lift, you know, like a chain lift to get the ice up into an ice house. Mm. And I couldn't match that up with either of the other two ice houses, which were different. So either they were burned and rebuilt, but I couldn't get enough to create a story for a Swain pond.
Octave LaRue.
Octave LaRue, that's it. And he was a Jersey Islander. So
that's Johnny's relative.
LaRue, yeah.
And that's
he lived in the house right here, the White House, Berrigan's house. Mm-hmm. That's where he lived.
Yeah, I remember it. I knew him.
Well, I have a presentation to do on this book, on North and West Chelmsford, and I had gathered some material on the Jersey Islanders from some of the people in town, and because I actually had so many pictures to put in the book, I didn't have any room for a Jersey Islander story. So that's going to be one of about 8 features in my presentation. So I was just working on that this week.
When are you doing that?
At the library on the 19th of January.
I'll have to tell Johnny. Does Johnny know that?
I don't think so. Although it's in the papers, so it'll be in the paper.
Great.
The 19th of January.
Right. At the library in the center.
I'll tell him. I'll see him tomorrow. I'll tell him.
Okay. Just a little commercial break there.
Yeah, commercial break. Okay, so, let me turn this off.
And the thing is with Swain, from what I understand, is he developed that turbine, but never so-called patented it, and
it was patented, but my understanding was he wanted to get into big turbines and big industry. And Bill Nolan says that had he stayed with, or maybe it was George Merrill, because he's a little closer to it. If he'd stayed with the smaller ones, he would have had a booming business because it was a niche market, and he kind of had a lock on efficient small turbines. Hmm. But instead, he went to bigger. So he outgrew this factory very rapidly and did move on. But when I was at the late, great Textile Museum, I saw... Luckily, I gathered a bunch of material, and I couldn't have done this book without the fire maps, because they actually showed over a number of years the layout of the mills down here in the West Chelmsford, and showed what I had the pictures, but I had no idea where.
How it fit together.
Yeah, like the steam engine. Where was it? So now with the fire maps, you know exactly what floors and what the function of each of those rooms was.
Cool.
So I was able to match them up. And then I had other sources that told actually who was the supervisor in certain areas at the time. So I was able to put together a decent story to go with the right. The pictures. They were roughly 1896 and 1906 with the time frames.
They may even be here somewhere. A throwaway fallen too. I don't know. Maybe kept one or not. That he was so pissed off about them that he probably didn't keep one. But they might be one.
So this is the inside diameter of the
one of the circles.
More recent
yeah.
Circles.
And there's an actual vise. Mm-hmm. In these jigs, I don't ever remember him working on these, but these jigs were all for circles. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't remember him working on those either.
But that was, you know, very early, probably very early in our lives.
Yeah.
You know.
It's pretty much done with it, you know.
But there's another one. You know, and there's another jig for, you know, that circle may very well be like the one that's in your picture, that's about that size, you know. But I always remember them being about yay big.
Mm-hmm. It was really rare that he worked on them.
Yeah. And then he had some, you know, specialty tools here that, you know, these were some type of dogs that would hold, you know, hold the circles in and stuff. And that's how I remember all this stuff here was all circle stuff. There's a primitive vise, something similar to one that's over here that he used to use. Things too, but I don't remember exactly what they were for. I think they had something to do with the when they did them in lead. I think 100% solder.
Well, there.
Okay, so
that's the iron bar he used to pin it, pound them down with, right, John?
Yep. There's one of the. There's a piece of the solder ones that they used to get. So there's two wires that connected them all together, and you'd use the solder to set them in the bar. And they soon found out that it was very difficult to, he couldn't quite get the knack of it to use that product. So they pretty much abandoned it.
Okay, so should we talk about like the drill bars?
Okay,
first,
so my recollection is the first drill bars that came that he worked on were called circles. The ones that I remember were, you know, a foot or foot and a half in diameter, and they had multiple rows of round, what we call round pins. These are the German. They call German round pins. They came all. Those are just old screws. You know what those are.
This one over here.
Just take some of these, I guess. God. They came in all. They made in. Those are English pins. But they're tapered. They came in all different lengths and diameters, depending on what was required for the drill bar.
Here's some at the bottom. These are really fine ones.
So these are 19 diameter by 1 5/8 long. So says the box. So it would have been. So that's a drill bar. So these bars came all different sizes. Some of them were done in reverse, depending on the machine. And that's a double row one. See, there's two. And there's one that's taller than the other. So those bars would come in That's probably one of the largest that would come. And like, just for instance, now that one had one broken tooth on it. So he would work with this little punches and whatever, and he would bang that back out the back side, and then he would set a new, whatever the size of the pin would, he'd reset that pin, clean that bar all up, he'd put it into this vise, which was bolted to here, and it would clamp, you know, he'd just clamp it in here like this. He'd clamp that in there like that. And he'd sit in a seat here for however long it would do, and he just had these little fine steel pipes. Some in here. So he had these pieces of, I don't know what they were called, but pipes. And he'd go in here and he'd tweak these things back and forth and straighten them all out, get them all fixed up, and then he'd put a little emery cloth on them and sharpen them back up again, and away they'd be ready to go. Now, if this bar came in heavily damaged, he would take it to this tool over here, and he would he'd pull down this thing with a jaw, and he would slice all those, you know, sharp. He'd slice that whole thing off. Yeah. Then he'd take it and put it in a steel vise. Take it into a steel vise. And lock it in there. Now those have a special jar on them that won't allow the fall to fall through, so it actually sits on the shelf. And then he'd take just a piece of steel bar and go bang, 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 drive those pins out, and then he'd reset those pins again with, you know, with the proper dimension pin, and then he'd run them over the emery belt, clean everything up again, make sure the bars were all nice and straight. He'd sit there for hours and do bang, 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 and look at them and twist them. He had a monkey wrench. He'd put them in here and he'd twist them with the monkey wrench and straighten them all out. And that's pretty much what he did. Now that's, I want to call that second generation of Falder bar. That's the drill bar. First generation was I believe was the circles. Now my recollection might not be correct, but that's the way that I remember it. Now the next generation would be the epoxy bar, which is this. So that would come, as you can see, that was pretty well all screwed up. Somebody's bubble gum or something. It was my father's best friend. Bubble gum or a cigarette butt get thrown into the hopper and into the machine it would go. These things would be, I think there was around 100 of these in the machine, and they were all rotating as they went through the machine. And when you get something foreign in there, it would really screw them up. It would bend them. It even get to the point where somebody had to use a pry bar to get them out of the machine, and they'd come to him and he'd straighten them and fix them all up. Now these are all what they call flat pins. These were set up as this would have been what they call a book. And we have all these, as you can see, they're all different numbers per inch and different thicknesses of pins, fine to coarse pins. What he would do is he would take these. Back then, I think it actually started off as being German pins, and then they couldn't supply them anymore, so we started buying the Japanese pins, which he didn't like either, because he was an American boy. And so what you would do is, I used to make all these styrofoams. I used to go to Lumberyard and buy sheets of styrofoam, and I'd run them through the table saw for them and make all these little pieces. And, you know, it's a perfect example of trying. You just didn't use it once. You used it as many times as you could, so you wouldn't have to throw it away. So you had four sides, and you might get three rows of each one. So then there was a wooden stick that went in here, and I can't seem to find one. There's a wooden stick in here, spacer. You close this up like that, and then you'd very meticulous work. Sit here and set all those flat pins in there.
Do that for hundreds of hours.
Hours and hours and hours. Used to be beer boxes full of these, all ready to go into the follow bar. So you put those in there like that. Just put them in loosely. Again, there was a wooden strip in here, so they would fall out. And then they'd take. Sorry, Fred. Gotcha. So then they would take this piece, and they'd set it over the top. And then they had another flat bar here. And they would, first the guy would take it and he'd just push it down by hand, and then he'd take the hammer and just tap it. So then it would make all those pieces all go into that bar, into that styrofoam, all perfect. So then the guy would peel back that, loosen the screws up, and that would drop down. So these things would be sitting all in there like that. These aren't probably the right pins, but these would be sitting in that styrofoam. And then they'd pull that out. And that would be the next process. So then this, when it was in that machine heated up, that's a full channel in there. So then they'd pour the epoxy in there, and they'd set this thing in there like that. And when the epoxy dried, they merely just peeled the styrofoam off, and you had a finished product. Once in a great while, you might get one pin that might be, that got a little bit jostled or something, and he'd just tweak it up a little bit to fix it, and away it would go. And that's basically what he did. And then so this is the last generation of follow bar that he worked on. And then they came up with this, all being plastic with the exception of the pins were steel, and they had, this was all pretty much plastic, and they had some plastic reinforcing on it. And when that got jammed up, they just threw it away.
Did they salvage the pins?
No.
They just threw the whole thing away?
All threw it away. And he was desperately trying to figure out how he could take that plastic bar and refit it for cheaper money than what they could buy another bar for, and was never able to do it. We spent hours and hours down here playing with those disposable bars. And so at any one time, there might have been probably at least two people making these replacements for these bars. These came in every week by the hundreds.
And so he got paid piecemeal by the bar, right?
Yeah.
And the people who worked for him got paid piecemeal?
No.
No, they get paid by the hour.
Yeah.
By the hour.
All right, the original drill bars, he was paid by, if he did a repair, they paid him so much per the repair. If he did a complete replacement, he get paid for the replacement. These here were complete replacement. The old epoxy ones were complete.
Right.
He get X amount of dollars to refab that. Yep.
Does the work would come in boxes just like this? I mean, it's exactly the way it
works. Those wooden trays?
Yep. Mm-hmm. There's one box here that's got some sides on it. I don't know what the hell happened with it. No, it's not that one. But they actually, the box is, oh, here it is, here. Now this box has got some old bars in it, but this was an original. That was the shipping box, and it was actually made for the exact size. When I was a kid, I used to build them boxes, and The boxes would come in all smashed up, so we couldn't reship them. So I'd rebuild the boxes for them, and then we'd put this here, and there'd be a plywood or a board top on it, and we'd nail it back down, screw it back down, and he'd label it, and off the onto the truck it would go. But they actually sat in there. And my recollection of was, I think the smallest was 5 inch. From here to here was 5 inch. And they went all the way up until probably about that. Well, those books wouldn't do anything bigger than that, so this was probably the largest of the epoxy bar.
And I can remember when I was a kid working for him, he had those boxes laid out here almost all the way to the ceiling.
Yeah.
How much work he had at one time.
Yep. So, can you tell us a story about your great grandfather?
Okay, so my great grandfather came from England, and he had a job in Lawrence.
Maybe one of these.
And he was killed in England. I don't know how exactly how that.
All labeled with a different size.
But he died in
all the different size pins.
And the people who owned the mill told his widow that when her sons were old enough, that they would have jobs in that mill. And they would have the job that they would want. So my grandfather, John Abbott, ended up going to work for that mill, and he became a wool sorter. And I understand that the reason why he became a wool sorter is because it was considered one of the premier jobs within the mills. That I guess they get paid a little bit better because they had a little bit more skill involved in terms of sorting the wool, in terms of the thickness and the length of the fibers and the softness of the fibers and that kind of thing. So they had different...
Made in Germany.
Different...
He had English. Grades, he had English pins as well.
Grades of wool that he would
German,
sort out.
German, English,
and
at the end
relatively
was all
clean job and relatively safe job. And so that was the reason why it was considered to be such a good profession. Mm-hmm.
And his brother Reuben also chose to be a wool sorter.
Yeah. And so that's how my father obviously had that connection with the mills when he was coming.
There's one of the wooden sticks that went into the books.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Sure.
Probably I made those problems for him on the tip.
Can you tell us about this green cabinet over there, which you mentioned earlier?
Yep. Where that cabinet came from, I don't know. I believe it's a belongs to a a library.
Like a card catalog?
Yeah, because there's no bottoms in the drawers. There's no bottoms at all in the drawers. I'm just to see the slip thing in here, go back and forth.
You want to leave it open for a second there? Just
it's like a card file.
Yeah, it really does look like a card file.
Yep.
And so he used that to store pins? Or?
Yes, exactly. That's what it is today. So all these different, all these numbers here are all the different size pins. Now what they mean, I really couldn't tell you. One of them is the diameter and one is the length. And from what I found in here, they're all either German pins or English pins. So that was his inventory, and there's a lot of stuff. You know, this thing here was all full of, at one time, was all full of pins as well. I think the German pins came in the boxes, and I think the English pins came in the cloth. I'm not 100% sure, but see, it might be a 16 gauge by 25, which is 1 8/4. 8/4 would be 2 inches. That'd be 3 inches long. Maybe it's 1 3/4. I don't know. So every bar was specific to a pin size, the drill bars. So depending on what they were combing, whether it was coarse or fine, the very, very fine stuff was used in the Worcester mills, because that was the very finest of the wool that went into this, you know, your clothing or whatever.
Your suits.
And then when it came to the flat pins, you could use the same bar, but change it up to however coarse you wanted it. He might have used this bar, but maybe used every other hole. See, this is seven pins per inch, but maybe they only wanted 3 pins per inch. So they could use, if he didn't have a bar that was 3 pins per inch, he could use that. So he would set whatever, however they wanted it set to what they were, to what they were combing. And again, you have the very fine, you know, very fine pieces. I mean, they were murder to try to, you used to sit there with your fingers and try to
22 twist per
them,
inch.
Push them in your, yeah, oh yeah, that's a, they were bastards.
Those were the worst.
Those were the bastards.
It was a pain in the neck. Made a lot of those.
Yeah, most of the stuff was all, hung up on the, a lot of it was all hung up on the thing there. Yep. And that was, this one here, this here was the first, this is the way that they used to set up the, for these things, I believe. I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that's what it was for. They put, that was part of a jig to do the soldering, but I'm not 100% sure.
That'll take a lot of the heat away.
Yeah. Small pins, eight per inch. Small pins, whatever the hell that meant. I never saw him use that. And this here, I don't. I know we always had this, and that again is a drill bar. So that was some kind of a specialty, some type of a specialty faller. Specialty bar that I don't ever remember him working on, but he had it. That might have been something that maybe came from, you know, Germany or, you know, another country, that maybe that's the way they did their followers. I don't know, but he always had that in his desk.
A really small machine.
My father never threw anything away. Nothing.
Did you talk about these where they were pre?
Yeah, that's those are the solder. Those are the solder joints.
Oh, that's part of the solder joints.
Yeah.
They were preset.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like this, what I do with that piece I had here. I have the whole bar. I don't know what's in here. What's here? That's the solder in there. He would buy them already done like that. And then,
oh, right.
And those bars, actually, those bars weren't slotted. They were, if you took this bar, you may find one in here somewhere, but if you took this bar, it opened up one side of that. That was all exposed, so he would take and lay that down, get it good and hot, and then he would lay that piece down in that hole there,
mm-hmm.
And then there's an electric iron over there, soldering iron, there's a gas-fired soldering iron over there, and then he would take and he'd melt that right down in there. But the problems that he was having was, if he didn't get that all cleaned out good, and say the flux was contaminated, or you put too much heat to it, you'd screw those up, and then you just have to clean it all out again and start over again. It was just wasn't a good time for him trying to figure those things out. And I think eventually he abandoned the whole.
Yeah.
Didn't do those anymore. But back in the heyday, back in the, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, there was lots and lots of these companies around that were doing this pin setting. And when my father finally retired, there was only one more on the whole East Coast, and that was in Rhode Island. There was an old timer there that continued on, and I'm sure he's long gone too. So, but everything moved down south.
I didn't know that.
Everything went down south. The funny thing I tell my kids, you know, you talk about things that are made in China and this and that. When David and I were growing up, my mother would go out and do the school shopping for us, buy us clothes for schools and stuff. And when it came back, if it didn't say made in the USA, it went out the door faster than it came in. Because he always used to say, you're cutting my own throat by doing that. It's very true. So that's pretty much my story about it. again, we could probably spend a lot of time looking at all the different style fallers, and I know them basically as circles, drill bars, and flat pin with epoxy. And I really don't know a lot about the circles. I remember him working on them, but a lot of the stuff that he had went down to the Windsor, down Low Lawrence Boulevard, the Windsor restaurant, before Lindsay bought it. And a lot of that stuff was all used for
decorations.
It was called the mill, or I guess it was called the mill, right? That was called years ago, the mill restaurant. So it was put in there for decorations, and I know we had a lot of circles. When I came in here about a month or so ago and I started cleaning, that underneath that bench there was loaded with stuff, and I thought for sure there was some old stuff under there, and there was actually nothing. It was just some junk that my father had collected over the years. So I was kind of disappointed that
so now that restaurant is closed, and
it's been changed hands.
You don't know where
that stuff is long.
Material
long gone.
Went.
Yeah, long gone.
Yeah, we never got to that restaurant.
Yeah. It's called Lindsay's now, I don't know. It's called the Mill.
I remember hearing about it. Yeah. My wife and I never got there.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Dick.
So,
you think that's the...
So what I'm going to offer to you is, anything you see here other than the vice in that cabinet, is here. Anything else that you'd like to take, I'm going to go through, and I'm going to take a few of the fall bars for my own. But.
Okay.
Now, you said something about a soldering iron. Is it old iron, and yeah, would this, they be interesting?
See, this thing here was some type of I want to call it an electric warming or something. He probably put the bolted the faller into that to keep it so it wouldn't get cold, keep it warm while he was in the soldering process. And... here's an old gas-fired soldering iron.
Gas-fired.
Acetylene-fired. Hold that up.
Oh, okay.
Then he soon found out that it probably wasn't the best thing to be using in the house. I don't know. These are some same idea type things. Pieces and parts. Here's an old... This is the one that I used to use, that he used to be hauling at me all the time. That's just, you know, you can still buy something like that today, which is just electric soldering iron. But, it's made out of, I believe it's copper.
That's probably copper.
And they would tin it and run that thing along that and try to, and if you ran it too much or too heavy, you would screw the pins up and then he'd be hollering at you.
Yeah, they use them for copper roofing and things like that.
Yeah.
They're doing that.
But other than that, there's nothing else that's here, so... He also used another product that was, I'm sure there's some here, but I just can't seem to find it. It was called brass. It was brass powder. And in the
brass
drill bar, in the... Don't you remember the little wooden dishes he had with the brass powder in?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was for the drill bars.
The drill bars. Yeah. If the pin went in it and didn't... If the drill bar was too worn and it wouldn't hold the tapered pin, he'd rub this brass dust into it.
Mm-hmm. That would make it a tighter fit.
Tighter fit. Nice. I'm sure there's probably a dish of it around here somewhere. I just can't seem to put my hands on it. But, well, in fact, hey...
There it is, speaking of brass dust.
Really?
But he had these little wooden dishes that he used to have on his... It's just ground up brass.
Didn't they add some oil or something to it?
Huh?
It was kind of oily.
Well, maybe when he put it in the wooden dish, maybe that's when he added the oil to it. Maybe.
Yeah.
And so then the heat would liquefy.
No, this is just friction.
Just friction. Kind of fill the hole a little bit.
Just fill the hole up a little bit. So we could.
No, it's an interesting technique that I hadn't heard of.
Yeah, you always call it brass dust, and I'm sure that's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pixie dust.
Pixie dust, yeah.
Yeah, that's a technique I hadn't heard of.
Yeah. Huh. Well, now I'll show you some of his. You can move some of this out of here. Maybe I'll show you some of his very primitive tools that he used. He used made pieces like this, and he put them in the vise. And he had another one that went the other direction, which I'm sure is there somewhere. And he'd take that faller bar.
Here's one, John.
You say that had a big kink in it. And he'd take and put that in there however he wanted to bend it, and you just tighten it up, and it would help him sway the bar, and then he'd pick it up, and as you can see on these vices, all the years of bang, 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 and then he'd sit in there, and he had an eye like an eagle. He'd get that just as straight as could be, take the twist out of him. So that's what he used for that. And you've seen the big steel bar that he would bang the pins out of.
Because he had learned welding before the war, so he could craft his own tools and machines.
A lot of the stuff came from the old pin shop that he had bought,
Farley
too.
Oh, Farley Kemp's?
Yeah. Stuff probably goes way back before.
What's that bar made out of? It's not lead, is it? Is it steel, or?
What's that?
What's that bar made
just
out
of? Just a piece of steel.
It's really, and it's been hammered.
It's really you can see the
banged up,
My dad had forearms like you wouldn't believe.
Papa had forearms.
It was just huge. He was doing that all day long.
There's a, take that from me. That's one of the gouges.
Yeah.
Oh, God, that shit hit me. But he had, gouges like this and this, and that's what he would use when he heated the bar up, and that's in this machine here. It would crystallize, and he'd take usually anything he could grab, and he'd just go, he'd grab it quick, put it in the vise, and just take something and just slide the pins out of it. And then he'd use these gouges, you know, very primitive, to get the epoxy out.
Ream it out.
Yep.
Clean out the channel.
Yep. And there's another, you know, another piece that he used to take and hammer on for a lot of use there. And here's the, you can still buy these today. These are modern tools.
Yeah.
Use that to use these to pull the pins out. He used to call them nippers.
Yep. And nippers.
Yep. Okay. You know, we had files and it's just it's just a pile of junk. Well, these are the old vices that he kept for something. Like I said, he never threw anything away. An old leather shoemaker's knife.
Yep.
For what? Who knows? You know, another pair of pliers. Always had. That was a pin setter's hammer.
Oh.
That's the only purpose for it. If you ever grabbed that and went upstairs to bang a nail on the wall or something, he'd have your head. He'd use a carpenter's hammer. That's a pin setter's hammer. So he'd use that to bang those pins down. It always had wooden handles.
Can I have it, John?
Yep.
Were there any other specialty hammers? That
not, not ever remember. Just... He might have had a ball peen hammer. I have no idea what that was for, but I'm sure it was for tweaking something. You know, that might have been just a big screwdriver, and he, at some point in time, somebody had made into something to do something special, maybe to straighten the pins out or something. Most of the stuff stayed in the drawers for there's another form of a gouge that he used. I mean, it's just a piece of flat steel and some old handle that he had for something and had somebody braze it on there for him.
Yeah, good eyeball.
There's another.
probably held that hammer for many
hours. I don't ever remember him using those tools, but there was another one. An old monkey wrench that he probably used to bend them around with, you know. And those were his tools. And then he bought these old shoe boxes here. There's an old, look at the per inch on that old piece of drill bar.
Jeez.
Well, that was pretty coarse.
Yeah.
You know.
The first run.
Yeah. He always had these brushes. When he worked here with this vise here, he's always used these little square brushes to clean out the debris and stuff. If it wasn't perfect and shiny, it didn't go out the door. The stuff here is, again, it was all just steel rods that he'd ground down, and he would take and, if he couldn't get that, say if that piece was broken right off there, there was no way to get to it. So he'd devise these different punches, and he'd go in there and he'd bang, bang, bang until he could get it out far enough that he could grab it with the pliers and pull it out. So he had dozens and dozens of these things, different sizes, but it was just, there's another punch there where maybe he would have taken, when he used this thing and it went down and didn't get him far enough, he'd go bang, bang, bang and make him go a little bit further. These are all his punches. But it's just, it's not something where you went down to the local hardware store and bought the tool, or you went to McKittrick's and bought the tool. It just wasn't. That thing there was made by somebody that he had, probably came along with the business. I mean, look at the grinder. Somebody made a table for it and an old motor, and away it went. It just made things to work. It wasn't, you didn't go to the Sears and Roebuck and bought a belt sander. You just didn't do that.
I can remember my father when I was a little boy going to his shop, and he had this thing going, and he'd be grinding the flour, and sparks would be coming out of that like crazy, hundreds a second. We were standing back here and watching him do that, and it's like he was enshrouded in all these sparks.
It was just dust. It's just dust that was grinding dust is all it was, metal dust. Yeah. That was, a glow. Now, what my father was doing with a jackhammer bit, like I said, he never threw anything away. He probably went to quarry one day and was laying on the ground and he saw that and asked JB, "What are you doing with that thing?" And he picked it up, put it in his pocket, brought it home, and said, "Maybe I'll make a punch or something out of it someday." Yeah, I mean, you may find another pin shop in the country somewhere, and they did things completely different, but that wasn't the way here. Whatever worked.
Was this part of his solder heating?
No, that was a propane stove, and what they would do is once they got the faller bars all ready for setting the epoxy, there used to be a big rack there, and it was. It all had slots in, so you could just set the baller in. So what they would do is they had a tin plate that went on the top of that stove, and they would get it fired up, and they whatever the run was for, say if you had 50 or 60 faller bars to be poured with the plastic, they'd put that on there and they'd warm the faller bar up, so that the plastic would flow in there, and then they'd set the pin in it. And then the guy would just set it in that rack. And the next day they'd come in and they'd, like I said, they'd peel all the styrofoams off and and then put them in, you know, inspect them, put them in a box, and away they'd go. And then they'd start all over again. Yep. But he had, he would go down to the Powers' liquor store, which is right where, what's his name's building is there, not Chester now, Polly's building. And he'd go in there and buy all the beer boxes, which were just cardboard boxes about yay high. And they'd be all stacked up here with all those styrofoams in them. Yep. They'd spend hours and hours and hours building those. One guy would be cleaning, you know, straightening. One guy would be over there building the styrofoams. And then when they were all ready, they went over there. And,
so it was like a curing station.
Exactly. He had a machine that's long gone. He actually had a machine with two parts. He poured the epoxy in, the hardener in, and he pulled the handle and it would give him the specific mixture. And then he'd have tongue depressors. Always used a styrofoam cup before, I don't know why, but always had a styrofoam cup. And they'd mix it up, and then the guy would actually take the styrofoam cup and he'd just crimp it a little bit, and he'd just go, when he got good at it, he'd just go, put it like that, and then flip that ready-made piece into it, and then put it up in there, the rack. My grandfather built all that, was a rack there, built all that, my mother's side for him. And then, eventually, when my father got poisoned by the epoxy, we moved it out to the back shed out back. He actually put electricity and heat out in the back shed, so they do all the epoxy work out there.
But they still ventilation.
He had to get it out of the house.
Yeah,
couldn't come in contact with that raw epoxy anymore. Yep. He ended up down to Mass General Fuss. I remember at least twice.
Twice, yeah.
His skin was just raw and just flaking off, and for years and years he went to bed with ripped up bed sheets with saline solution, and my mother would wrap in between his fingers and everything, and then they put plastic bags and then tape it all together, and that's the way he went to bed. And come to find out it was the epoxy head, because he was in here, he'd get it all over his hands and didn't give a shit and breathing it, and it attacked the system, and so he'd get real, real bad with it, and you know, it was almost to the point where they were even thinking about taking his fingers and hands off, because there was no skin left, you know. So they would bring him into the hospital and get him into the, you know, somewhat of a more of a sterile situation, and it would clear up, and then he'd come home, and he was down there for a couple times. So. And that's when he stopped. He couldn't do the epoxy work anymore. And then one of the guys took it over. And like I said, he used to go out there and listen to Charles Lacordaire on the radio and BCN and Scotty.
Yeah.
And pour out there for hours and then come back in, and then he'd sit at this desk here and this bench here, and he'd make tomorrow's work.
So it was a real cottage industry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then when they closed, my father decided to close up his end of the business and start collecting his Social Security, they kept the business going under my mother. And my mother would go, my father would do all the work down here, and my mother would go out into the shop for a few years. And at the same time, she was working for Medical Associates at the time as the executive secretary over there. And she'd come home after hours and Saturdays and Sundays and do the epoxy work. And then eventually they just decided that they couldn't do it anymore and couldn't compete anymore or whatever. And they decided they just walked and pretty much just shut the lights off and walked away from it.
She never got allergic to the epoxy?
No. But then we were using plastic gloves and they had a real good ventilation system out there. They had two big fans. So it wasn't like my father had doing it. Was doing it with his bare hands and breathing it without the system here. So
it's like asbestos. Nobody told him it was a hazard.
And another thing too is my father was a ship welder. He had what's it called? Where you got the fiber in your lung there, it crosses a
mesothelioma.
Yeah, he had that, but it never came into cancer. They always watched that. They knew the fibers were there. They could see them on the x-rays, but it never...
He was lucky there.
He says he gets stories of down there. They used to take the stuff and throw it at each other.
So I think Dave told me he thought it was 1982 when your dad retired. He would have been 65.
He took it. He took no, his... 62. No, 62.
Yeah.
So...
And he got beat up real bad with his... With his
so that was the end of the business.
His Social Security payment. And then it continued on until... I believe it continued on until... they bought the beach house in 1980. So it might have been 1978, maybe 79, maybe as long as 1980. And then they actually... My mother gave it up too.
Okay.
Which beach?
Hampton. Way up the north end. And everything's pretty much just stayed in here until, you know, I've just started taking things apart. I took that bench down there the last couple of weeks. And
he was so able to put, you know, sons through college and technical high schools and, you know,
he did, made a good living. You know, during his day, I think he did real well.
Yeah, he did good business.
Had a good business, but unfortunately he had some ill-advised investment people, and he was always afraid of his money. You know, he would never trust anybody with it, even his own two sons, when it came down to, you know, his final...
Take over the estate?
The estate planning. He wouldn't trust my brother and I.
Oh, that's true.
No. No.
It was hard-earned.
Yeah.
My mother... To put back in the box.
My mother... you want that?
If they want to take it, they can.
If it's the only one, it would go.
I'm sure there's more
with
in
the
here
collection.
Somewhere.
But if there's, I raised some eyebrows at the security check.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right.
Okay, I'm gonna stop recording. Turn this off. Turn this off.